Blog Talk Radio.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Good common sense and sound judgment of the American people. And their essential love of justice.
Hi, welcome to the Kudzu Vine. We're having a little bit of a remote show. I'm sitting in a empty bus stop in Cobb County. But luckily we have Tim and Catherine at their home locations with all the nice computer access. Welcome, Catherine and Tim.
Hey, David.
Hello.
Hey, Tim.
Hello.
Yes. Good to have y'all and going to have a big show. I need to go ahead and let everybody know it was totally my fault, but not Andy Brack's fault on last week's show. I transposed some numbers, and I gave him the wrong number, and so that is completely my bad. But Andy's willing to line it up again and come on this week. And then in the second half hour, we got our congressional candidate from the 7th District, Doug Heckman, who announced this week, and he's going to fill in us about his campaign against John Linder. So, big show, but beyond that, there's a lot of topics to talk about. And the legislative session, I had predicted, like we did last year, and I would thought that we would have a lot of talk throughout the session, but we really didn't have a lot because there really wasn't a lot getting done. Tim, what do you think about that?
You're being charitable, David. I can't think of much of anything that got done, except I think you can now carry a concealed weapon in that rest stop that you're sitting in, if I'm not mistaken. Other than that, I can think of nothing of substance that got done. It's pathetic.
Lots of whining and lots of waiting for the session to be over so they can all start raising money for their campaigns.
Yes, and that seems to be a perpetual cycle at any level of government with anybody in control. Just don't get anything passed because it's the next campaign where you have to raise money or you have to have something to campaign on. And as a citizen, that's very sad. I will say this. I'm very glad as a school teacher that believes that vouchers are a bit of a false hope for a lot of folks. I'm glad that that didn't get passed. So I guess some of their inability I'm kind of joyful at. But the meltdown that Glenn Richardson had at the very end of Friday night. I mean, Catherine, what are your thoughts on that?
Oh, they're just a bunch of whining babies, you know. They got power and they don't know what to do with it, and they don't know how to serve the citizens of Georgia. And then when they don't get everything they want, they just whine about it. I think it's pathetic, sad. But like you, I'm kind of glad that they didn't get, you know, they didn't push through all this crap they wanted to, because most of it wouldn't have been in our best interest, I think. So.
Yes, I think Glenn Richardson is trying to make a play to knock Casey Cagle out now, but then I think what he may do is knock each other out. The conservatives are not going to like Cagle because he didn't pass the tax increases, but they're not going to see Glenn Richardson as a leader.
No, I don't think so.
I'm seeing him as a nut, David. I mean, he was overheard questioning the lieutenant governor's manhood, among other things. And you talk about somebody, and this has been a popular theme in the last few days, you talk about somebody that needs to take a chill pill. I believe the speaker is one that does it. It's almost like he's coming unhinged. He can't control his own body. He certainly can't work with the other body. And he and the governor can't stand each other. And so what was the big theme of this session of the legislature? The fighting.
Yes, I mean, that's really all it was. I mean, you didn't even have a Go Fish program that got passed this time. That's how weak the session was. I mean, when you're looking back finally to last year and Go Fish, that's what we're stuck with.
Yeah, well, let me ask you this. What are they going to go home and run on this fall?
Well, I think that's what several people have written. I know Bill Shipp wrote a column. You've seen on some of the blogs. I think John had something on Tommy's Tavern. I think Andre had something on his blog. They all said, this is an opening for the Democratic Party. Can we take advantage of it? Are we in the position to have enough money to, you know, get our ideas out there?
Well, you know, another thing, too, in the last several election cycles, the Republicans, especially since they've taken power, have managed to get some issue on the ballot of a constitutional nature, like gay marriage or something like that, that would drive their voters to the polls. Hey, not so this year, because it all went up in flames in the legislature. So I wonder how motivated their voters are going to be. Or are they just trusting that that many Republicans now reside in Georgia that they're going to win no matter what?
Well, and it may be that as far as they say the presidential, the people that fall for these gay marriage initiative, little trap votes, I mean, those are the same kind of clowns, I think, that you can talk about Barack Obama being a Muslim or that evil Hillary Clinton, how she's some radical woman that wants to, you know, do away with men. And I think those, you can still sell that to that very narrow slice of voters that they can use to get the percentage point or two they need in some districts.
And the independent voters that they might get with these conservative social issues, what of them?
Yeah, and I'm not so sure about that, David, because honestly, what kind of, I mean, how are they going to, they're going to need some money. I mean, they've got money, but they don't have endless sources of money. And is the National Party going to look down here and go, what the hell are you guys doing? We're not going to help you this time.
Well, and not so much the National Party, but it should be that some of these business interests, that they're not getting anything done for. I mean, some of these business interests probably need some type of infrastructure to move people around the state. They need they need some type of water resources. They want to see education move forward, and they're not getting any of that. So they
don't forget transportation.
Oh, that's what I mean. Moving people around. I mean, and they're not getting any of that. So you think that some of those folks would start to say, look, this is just pathetic. Even if some of the hardcore Republicans may say, I'm not going to start giving to Democrats, but I've got better things I can do with my money. I mean, that may be what happens first in some cases.
Yeah, and then Sonny's gone to Japan, to China for the, you know, most of the week.
Yeah, it really, him going to China I have no problem with, because, I mean, that is a foreign country, and that's what folks are supposed to do. We know Tommy Irvin, you know, goes to other countries, try to do agriculture deals. The timing of it was, you know, problematic. Why couldn't he have done this in 2 weeks? 3 weeks. I mean, I know you don't know exactly when the session's going to end, but knowing how recently the Republicans would like to drag out the session, you know they're going to have April all the way covered.
I might add, David, about that Purdue trip, as soon as he gets back, he will be getting out his veto pen and vetoing quite a lot of stuff that they did manage to pass,
Is there to veto, Tim? Tell me what there's to veto.
Well, maybe a few spending measures and pet projects to try to balance a terrible budget, for one thing. It'll be just one more thing that members will not have to run on. If they can bring home some port, they can run on that. If he has to slash it from the budget, hey, sorry, that won't be there either.
But the thing I will say is if you didn't do tax cuts, you will have more money, theoretically, to then do projects, be they good or bad. I personally wish that they would go ahead and put back some of the education funding first. To me, that would have been, the Democrats early in the session had something like this. Put back all of the education money that's been cut over the last 5 years. Then, after that, do tax cuts.
And they won't do that, and you know why? They'll use the recession as an excuse to do it. And, David, I believe our first guest is with us.
Okay, Andy Brack from South Carolina State House Report. Welcome, Andy.
Thank you, guys. How are you?
Hey.
Doing well. Andy, just so you know, you're on here with Tim Shiflett and Catherine Smith, the co-host of the Kudzu Vine.
Right.
And
how
so
y'all
they'll
doing?
Be. Good. They'll be giving lots of questions to you as well. But, Andy, you're over there covering South Carolina politics. I noticed that y'all have a competitive U.S. Senate race as far as there's two candidates. Lindsey Graham, much like Saxby Chambliss here in Georgia, will be going for his first reelection. I know the first reelection is usually a critical one for a senator.
Right.
How's that campaign shaping up?
You know, a few years ago I ran as a Democrat for Congress down here. And – It's hard to believe, but I don't even know who the Democrat is in that race. I don't know if there is one yet. Lindsey Graham is a shoe-in for that race. He's got a guy named Buddy Witherspoon, who is a dyed-in-the-wool lockstep Republican. He's on the Republican National Committee, and he thinks Lindsey Graham is too liberal. He's got no chance in the world of beating Lindsey Graham, who's got $8 or $9 million in his bank account. So, you know, look for that one to stay in the Republican column.
Yes. Now there is a candidate. Tim, do you have politics one pulled up just so you can give that name to Andy in case that jogs the memory?
Well, actually, I do not, and I'm going to go to it because
I'm working on it right now. I'm working on it right now. I'll get it.
The name, because it may jog the memory. There is a candidate we saw qualified. He obviously is not a heavy-funded big hitter, if you will.
No. Well, I'm trying to pull it up here, too, but anyway.
Andy, that tells us if someone of your knowledge base in South Carolina politics doesn't know the guy, then
obviously I see his name is Michael Cohn.
Michael Cohn, he's not been sending out press releases like he should.
No.
He's not making himself known, so maybe this will be kind of a warning sign to him to change this thing around, at least to make a decent showing, I mean, not to embarrass himself. Well, I guess so there's also some competitive House races. Tell us what you can about those races that are competitive.
You know, let me just so y'all know, most of the stuff that we do at State House Report, which you can get to at statehousereport.com, focuses on South Carolina politics, and we do some federal stuff, but we don't really focus as much on that. But that being said, in the first congressional, there's six congressional districts in South Carolina. Four of them are considered Republican. Two of them are considered Democratic. The in the first congressional district is a guy named Henry Brown, who was the guy that I lost to back in 2000 when it was an open seat. Henry Brown has done absolutely nothing in the first congressional district to be proud of. He's been just a vote that whenever the Republicans tell him to vote for something, he does it without thinking. He is being challenged by a well-funded candidate named Linda Kettner from Charleston. Now, both of them have a little bit of primary opposition, but both of them should get past it pretty easily. Kettner is a newcomer in politics down here, but she's very well connected and well healed. I don't know if in Georgia in North Georgia they have some of the Food Line grocery stores, but her family founded Food Line there in North Carolina, and so she's been down here for about 25 years. In the second district, you've got Congressman Joe Wilson, who was elected about 2000 as well. He replaced Floyd Spence. There are a couple of interesting candidates there. One of the most interesting is a fellow named Rob Miller, who's an Iraq War veteran, and he's running against them, and he's supposedly taking a good stab at it. In the third congressional district, you've got a guy named Gresham Barrett, who's running for his third or fourth time to keep the seat as a Republican. He's being challenged by a woman named Jane Dyer, who is a FedEx pilot and an Air Force veteran. I don't know much about that race. It has not gotten much publicity at this point. In the fourth congressional district, there are three Democrats running against Bob Inglis, who is the incumbent. And Inglis, you may remember, was one of these guys who was for term limits. And so after three term limits, he said he decided instead of doing like Mark Sanford did and getting out of the Congress, instead Inglis ran against Hollings to be a U.S. senator. Well, then when he lost that one, you know, lo and behold, after Jim DeMint ran for – who took over Inglis' seat, after he decided to run for Senate to take over – and he eventually took over Hollings' seat because Hollings didn't run again – but Inglis decided, what the hell, I'll run for this seat myself for a second time. But guess what he did the second time? Nothing about term limits the second time. I mean, these guys, you know, it's just hilarious. They find the political hot-button issue of the day, whether it's, you know, term limits, whether it's you know, the Terry Schiavo stuff, whatever it is out there that they can say at the time to get elected, they'll say to get elected. But Inglis now is he's got three Democrats challenging him for that, and he's actually got primary opposition, which is somewhat surprising. You know, incumbent congressmen don't get a lot of primary opposition. And then in the 5th Congressional District is a Democratic seat up around York, around Charlotte, and that's held by John Spratt, who's a veteran House member, chairman of the House Budget Committee, and very well respected. He's got token opposition, as does Jim Clyburn, who is in the 6th Congressional District, which is kind of the amoeba district that runs between Florence, Charleston, and Columbia. He obviously is a very important fellow, ranking 3rd in the House leadership. So it ought to be fun this time. I tend to think that most of the seats will probably stay about the same. I don't see anybody really poised to pick off somebody else. And the main reason, as y'all alluded to earlier, is if you're running for something like this, it's not a 6-month deal. It's a 2-year battle, and you really have to get out there well ahead of time to make a name for yourself and to connect with people.
Yes, so it sounds like the district that's currently held by Henry Brown, that's probably the most competitive of the federal seats, including the U.S. Senate race.
Well, you know, you'd think that, but, you know, and Linda Kettner is a good friend of mine, and I've given money to her campaign, but, you know, you got to face the political reality, too. She's gay. So, you know, that's going to cause a problem. I mean, in a lot of voters' eyes. It shouldn't, but it may. And so, you know, you just don't know what's going to happen. I think Brown has an edge just simply because of that. It shouldn't be that way. We need to get over that kind of stuff. But I don't think a lot of people have, at least in South Carolina, where we, I think, tied Georgia at the bottom of education, I don't think that a lot of people can get beyond that kind of stuff.
Yes, and that is true. And that just sounded like on paper, the way you're talking about it, the district's the most competitive.
Yep.
Well, I guess, and also another theme I noticed, you had 2 or 3 veterans running for seats.
Yep.
Do you see in South Carolina, like we have in other states, where a lot of veterans are running as Democrats this cycle and really last as well?
Yeah, and I think that's going to become something that's even bigger. We've got a guy here that I predict in 2 years or 6 years will become the next governor. A fellow named James Smith, who was the House Minority Leader, and he's an interesting fella. He was a lieutenant in the Reserves, Army Reserves, and then he was in the Judge Advocates Corps. In other words, he was a lawyer for the Army.
Mm-hmm.
And then when the war started and stuff, he got switched, and he went back to being a private so that he could get in an infantry group. He subsequently went back to being an officer because of his leadership, and he's over in Afghanistan right now with about 2,000 South Carolina troops that are stationed over there, and they're soon to come home again. But he's been going out on missions, you know, quite frequently, and apparently is making quite a name for himself. And I look for that experience in leadership over in Afghanistan to be something that propels him into statewide politics. People in South Carolina, like people in Georgia, have a healthy respect for the military experience, and I think that it's going to be a feather in the cap. You know, one of the things that Democrats suffer from is people don't think that they're tough. Well, you know, when a guy's going and getting shot at every night, it's pretty tough. So I think that's going to build, that will build the resume and the credentials of a lot of candidates this cycle and in future cycles.
Yes, well, I was going to ask you one more question, and I'm going to turn it over then to Tim and Catherine for questions for a little while after that. Andy, you talked about state house politics kind of being your bread and butter there.
Right.
Tell us about some of the key issues then going on for state government in South Carolina.
All right, there's been a few things that have been going on. South Carolina has the lowest cigarette tax in the country right now, at 7 cents a pack. And there's been moves afoot every year to raise the cigarette tax, but for one reason or another, there hadn't been the political wherewithal to do it. This year, when our state, like many, are facing budget crunches and where they're going to have across-the-board cuts. I think legislators are finally looking at the idea that, yeah, you know, we might be able to raise the cigarette tax because we need to have extra funds go to increases needed in Medicare, Medicaid, and other health programs. So I would look for there's a bill out there now that seems to be pretty well respected on both sides of the aisle to raise the tax by 50 cents, which would bring in about $160 million to the state's coffers, which, you know, when you're trying to you can match a lot of federal dollars with that stuff, so we ought to be able to get about 3-to-1 match on that. So we ought to be able to bring in another extra $500,000 to go to health care costs in this state, $500 million, excuse me, to go to health care costs here, which is a big deal. So I think that's something that's going on. The other things that are going on here is there are, if y'all recall, last summer there was a big sofa warehouse here in Charleston. It's actually right up the street from my house that caught on fire and 9 firefighters died. That was big national news. There is a bill in the legislature now to strongly urge or require commercial establishments to have sprinkler systems, and that's being fought out, and that's a pretty big deal here because had there been a sprinkler system mandated in that building, it's a thought by a lot of people that those guys wouldn't have died. So the sprinkler bill, cigarette tax hike, there is some big interest in clamping down on payday lending here, which has been a big problem. One of the biggest companies in payday lending is located in Spartanburg. They've made gazillions of dollars, and I think people are a little bit annoyed by the predatory nature of it, but they do realize that there are some people who won't qualify for short-term loans at banks, and so they want to try to figure out a way to make it so that this kind of lending can happen, but not at the astronomical interest rates that some of these places charge. You know, you'd think that there'd be a bunch of education legislation in, but there's really not here. Some of the colleges are getting cuts pretty big this year. As far as high school and elementary school education, doesn't seem like there's any big changes. Excuse me. Sorry, I got a 4-year-old that just wants to say goodnight. As far as the high school and elementary education, this is a year that people are studying various proposals on ways to change the testing. I don't know. I grew up in Georgia, and I just don't remember I remember we had a whole bunch of tests when I was a kid in school, but I don't really know what y'all do now for all these tests that these kids are required. But we've got some pretty strict tests over here in South Carolina, and some of the teachers and some of the parents feel like they're being tested way too much and that all they're doing is preparing for the test instead of learning the 3 R's. And so there's a look at, is there a way to continue to get the results that are needed so you can see, track how the progress is, but maybe not doing it as much. So that's about what's going on. And I guess the only other thing really that's a statewide issue that the legislature is not getting involved really is there's starting to be a lot of scrutiny into whether there should be another coal-fired power plant here in the PD part of the state, which is near Florence. The group that wants to build it is called Santee Cooper, which is a state-owned utility, and they sell off power to a lot of the co-ops and stuff. But you know, they say that they need a new generation plant, and a lot of the environmental groups say, well, that's fine, but this is not the right way to do it, and this is not the right time to do it, especially when that area has a significantly high mercury problem in the streams. And people think that adding another plant to it isn't going to help things at all. So that's kind of politically what's going on here. Besides, you know, I'm sure that y'all want to talk a little bit about this presidential junk that we still seem to be getting in the news about.
Well, Mr. Brack, funny you should mention the presidential race, but I was this is Tim Shipley. David had to step away for a few minutes because he's on the road. But I did want to ask you about the presidential race.
Yeah.
You know, South Carolina obviously was very pivotal earlier this year. One thing I was wondering about, what happened to John Edwards there?
You know, I think most of your listeners probably know that John Edwards was a native son from South Carolina and then moved and grew up in North Carolina. In 2004, this was a state that Edwards won, and it kind of propelled a lot of people to look at him. And you might even say that because he did so well here, he ended up being on the ticket as a vice presidential nominee. He just didn't catch on this time. I mean, I think people, you know, he might have been 6 months too early in a lot of ways because the kind of economic things that he was talking about, people are feeling now. And people are talking about when they say $3.15 gas, or they see, you know, milk and all sorts of other produce that are going way high, and so they're seeing it in the gas tanks and they're seeing it in the grocery carts. And I think that his message would be a lot more, people listen to it a little bit more now than they would 6-8 months ago. But you know, you had two rock stars running. You had Clinton and you had Obama, and Edwards just wasn't quite up there, and he just couldn't compete with those rock star qualities. And you know, I think people just kind of figured he'd had his shot, and they wanted to take a look at these other two. I don't know. I voted for Edwards because I thought that he was the guy that had the best message for America, and you know, so.
The other thing about your primary was, of course, Bill Clinton and what he said. Now, how do you think that affected the overall vote there, or did it affect it?
You know, when the media from outside South Carolina came in waves for the last 3 or 4 weeks after New Hampshire, that kind of stuff, the comments that Clinton made and the responses that were made and then the ads that happened and all that stuff, that kind of top-level stuff probably made a little bit of difference to some people. But I think that that because the Obama campaign had spent months here working very quietly at the beginning in building a machine, I think that's what won it for Obama. It was the investment starting last year at this time. I remember I went up to Columbia at probably in March of last year, and I walked in the Obama office because a friend of mine was running it here, and I couldn't believe it. I walked in and there were 20 people working. I mean, this was almost 10 months from the primary. And most statewide campaigns here don't have 20 people running, you know, in the office even on election day. So I mean, it was a heck of an effort. And by the time election day got here, these people had, you know, hundreds and hundreds of volunteers. I mean, just let me give you one metric. They had, you know, the time that Obama kind of clicked with a lot more people was when Oprah came down here and they had a rally at the big stadium in Columbia. Well, 30,000 people showed up, and I don't know when the last time anywhere in the South 30,000 people showed up for a political rally.
But NASCAR, right?
Well, exactly. I mean, or football. I mean, come on now, go over to Sanford Stadium. But 30,000 people showed up. They signed up 2,000 volunteers that day, and they had 1,500 volunteers working. I mean, these guys were so well organized, and it just blew me away. And I think that organization of connecting with people in everywhere from beauty shops and barbershops to, you know, big football rallies to I don't know how many automated phone calls I got. I got so sick of them, it wasn't even funny. But I mean, there was just it was a massive political branding and organizing effort. That's why Obama won here. I mean, at the same time that Obama was having, you know, he had offices all over the state, and Clinton opened her office about a month and a half before the primary here in Charleston. So, I mean, it just was, they seemed to always be playing catch-up, and I think that he was always ahead here pretty much.
Andy, this is
Catherine.
Ma'am. From
Hey, Catherine.
I'm in Atlanta.
Right. I'm sorry.
I think it's I'm what?
I'm sorry.
I like it here.
Well, I went to high school in Atlanta. So.
Well, I think it's great. I love to hear about organizing on the ground. I think it's often the key to success in elections. I believe that. Are any of those Obama people still in South Carolina? And are they continuing the work to make sure that all those people that came out for the primary will come out for the election? And
you know,
how well do they play with the state party? And how strong is your state party? Kind of a twofold question.
The state party isn't very strong, but we've got a chair who's doing a pretty good job, and I think that it's been getting stronger over the last few years. The South Carolina Democratic Party has been playing catch up for a long time because on.
Well, we know that club.
Yeah. So, yeah, but we've had it a lot longer than y'all did. I mean, heck, they had 1962 was when Floyd Spence switched over to becoming a Republican, and that just started it all. But I think that first of all, most of the staff folks. Who were the paid people who were here, they're gone.
Of course.
I mean, you know, the lady that ran the office here in South Carolina was, I got an email from her, she's the deputy campaign director in Indiana now, because that's where they're thinking next that they're going to have to go. There's a guy that was a political director here who, I don't even know where he is now, he's probably in Pennsylvania because he's from up that way. So, most of those paid folks have gone. I think what's amazing to me is to ride around and still see some of the signs up, still see the stickers out, still see people. There's a lady that got out of we have the Piggly Wigglies here too. And there was a lady that got out of the Piggly Wiggly yesterday who had an Obama for President shirt on. I mean, you know, for people to make that investment in publicity, those people are going to be active when it comes, because, I mean, they're wearing T-shirts here in April. It's going to happen. I think that it's going to be an extremely interesting election. It's going to be very difficult for South Carolina if, let's say, Obama ends up being the candidate. It's going to be very difficult for South Carolina to go Obama. But I'm of the belief, and I've been arguing this for years with people, that the national party needs to invest resources, like Howard Dean's been doing, needs to invest resources throughout the South, because you don't have to win the whole solid South. But if you can pick up two states, minimum of two southern states out of the 11 or 12 southern states, the Democratic Party will win every time. And, I mean, just do the math. If we had won Tennessee back in 2000, Gore would be president, had been president. You know,
right. If it doesn't win this time, it strengthens the party for next time. I mean, I think that we have to have a long view of these things. And instead of thinking of it as a campaign, we think of it as a party that we're building for the future, instead of just trying to win an election in the next, 10 months.
And I believe David has rejoined us, haven't you, David?
Yes, I had to drop out for a minute because of being on the road, but Andy, what I was with you earlier and heard back the last 5 minutes, you've just done an outstanding interview catching up with us on South Carolina politics, and I think I've told you off the air, but I want to talk about, so we would like to have Andy as a recurring guest to kind of brief us on South Carolina politics from time to time.
Well, y'all just let me know, when it is, and I'll try to call the right number next time.
Oh, that would be totally my fault. Andy, if you listen to the broadcast at the start of the show, I totally took
time.
The blame. I understand. Well, but Andy, once again, it's great having you on, and we look forward to doing it in the future.
And if y'all ever need anything, just go to statehousereport.com. It used to be paid, and now it's free, so you can keep up every week.
That will be an excellent resource for folks.
It's a great resource.
Thanks, Catherine. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank Tim. Thank David. Bye-bye.
Good night. Bye-bye.
Okay, David, I believe our next guest is about to join us. Let's see if we can get him on here. I'm clicking, and so far it's not doing anything. Ah, the perils of live radio, guys. No, I'm having trouble with it, David. I cannot get this other person on here. So while I'm working on this, can we talk about something else? Are y'all with me?
Yeah, of course we can talk about something else. There's plenty of things to talk about.
David, are you still with us?
David's
no, we, we've lost David. Huh. Although it shows that he's still on here. Might just be me and you, Catherine.
Well, that's
looks fine. Looks like the old Blog Talk switchboard is giving us some problems. One thing I wanted to ask you about, though, was some more political news that happened this week, and that was the fact that Maggie Martinez dropped out of the race.
She did. I went to the they had a debate on Tuesday night or Wednesday night at Emory, and I was kind of expecting to see her, but she had just made the announcement, I think, that day, or maybe the next day. But that didn't surprise me. I don't think it surprised anybody. I think
I believe we might have our... No, we lost our guest. David, are you back with us?
If you're letting me be back, I am.
Yeah,
if
I'm letting
me be back.
Yeah, you're back, but we had a little problem with the switchboard, and we lost our other guest, I believe, if he's listening.
Doug will call right back and then try right back in, and we can unget him.
Okay, I'm on here now.
Okay. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir. We got you.
Yay.
All right, Hi, Doug. We have a few
I hopped off and got back on.
That's what usually works. And we have a few little difficulties here, but this is because Kudzuvine is a new innovative service, and it's free, which we like as well. So we do what we can. But, Doug, we're
Sounds
glad
good.
To have you on here. We know last
Thanks.
Monday you announced your candidacy for the 7th Congressional District. I know your website's up, DougHegman.com. Go ahead and tell us what you can about your biography, about your background.
Well, is that David that was asking the question here or making
yes.
comments first?
This is
okay.
David.
All right. Hey, thanks, David. Well, you know, my background, I split up on the website into two lives, and certainly a big part of my campaign has to do with my military background. But let me start out with the civilian part first. And I've been married for 26 years to the same woman. Her name is Pat, and I've got three children, all still at home. And one's 17, a boy, one's 16, a boy, and a 13-year-old girl. And life is good in the suburbs of Atlanta, as they say. I've lived in Gwinnett County now for over 17 years, so I've been a resident for a long time now. As you'll hear in my military bio, I've been gone for a few of those years, war on terror, but otherwise I've lived there. As a civilian, my job has been for the last 20 years, after I got out of active duty, I work for a financial services firm, but I'm about to leave that job in the next couple weeks to run full-time through the November elections, and then I plan to split my time between the suburbs of Atlanta and Washington, D.C. as an optimistic guy. My educational background includes graduating from West Point in the early 80s, and then in the late 80s, after I got off active duty, I got an MBA from Duke University, who used to be a good basketball school. On the military side, I spent my active duty years in the 80s as an infantry and then a special operations officer, spending time in the Middle East, being an A-team leader. In the 90s, and as a reservist in Atlanta, I would work with Special Operations Command out of Fort Bragg and spend time in Central America. And then 9/11 hit. Went to the Afghanistan area on the special operations there. I expected to be gone for a year there, but spent about 4 months over there. We got done faster than we thought with the initial, as you remember, sweeping the Taliban out, came back to Fort Bragg for the rest of my year. And then 2006, 2007, to finish my bio, as a colonel in the Army. I was lead advisor in Baghdad, started the surge before I left, and then I came home. Go ahead, Dave.
You've been in both, theaters, if you will, both Afghanistan Iraq, which is, I think, the most unique of the candidates we've had this year. We've had a good handful of folks that have been in Iraq. I don't believe we've had anybody that's been in Afghanistan. So kind of compare the two and contrast the two. Because I know if you ask popularity or approval-wise, you know, the Afghanistan front probably enjoys about 90% approval, certainly when it started. And I don't know if it continues to be asked separately, whereas the Iraq war started maybe as high as 70, has gone down. And so in the American public's eyes, they're different. Do you see them as different?
And they are. Certainly, and we all know this now for sure, and I guess there was some question early on, but, you know, we know for sure that the people in Afghanistan were responsible for 9/11, basically, whereas Iraq was tenuous at best from the beginning, and it's been disproved since then. So kind of the essence of our involvement in both places has some differences, as everybody understands. And certainly the amount of U.S. military and otherwise commitment is vastly different. The war in Afghanistan involves maybe, and I'm being on the high side here, 20,000 U.S. soldiers, whereas Iraq is 150, 160. So the scope of operations is vastly, vastly different. From personal experience, as you remember, you know, I got over there in a couple of weeks after 9/11, so there was nothing over there. There were a few hundred of us that were training the Northern Alliance to kick the Taliban out. It happened a lot faster than we thought it would, and then I came back. So, you know, and the other compare and contrast point I would make is Afghanistan is a genuine third world country, whereas Iraq has a lot of infrastructure, a lot of education. Yes, it was a welfare state, but it was absolutely a high-level third-world country, whereas Afghanistan was and is a relatively low-level third-world country. So a little from a compare and contrast. One of the issues that I have with the Republican positions, as well as with our government, having been over to Iraq relatively recently and spent over a year there, is that yes, the surge is working on the ground from the standpoint of more American soldiers, more involvement, and making the place more peaceful, and the metric being injuries has gone way down, whether it's Iraqi civilians or American soldiers, and that is all very good. But the reason we did the surge, and this is where it kind of gets lost, I think, and we're going to hear testimony from General Petraeus this week, and he's going to paint a picture that the surge has been effective, and he's right. On the ground, we have, under any metric, decrease the violence, but the intent of the surge, and he'll talk about this, was to provide breathing space or stability for the Iraqi government to stand up and do what governments do, provide a just society, provide infrastructure, update, maintain infrastructure, all those kinds of things. Is that happening? It's happening a lot slower than we want, if at all, in many places. And there are some metrics to measure what the Iraqi government is doing. Our Congress put in place a year and a half ago, 24 milestones that they had to pass. They've passed a handful. I mean, count them on one or two hands. So they are going real slow. It's been over 5 years now, and it's my opinion, having been there, that they are gaming us, as I would put in quotation marks on my website. They know what our agenda is. We think we know what theirs is, and we really don't on some levels. There's an awful lot of history and politics over there. So it's my position that certainly this administration is going to stretch out until the next president comes in what they're doing now, in controversial to what they led us to believe a year ago. And I just think that's wrong, and we've got to push the Iraqi government faster into doing the things they're supposed to do. How do we do that? The way that's being done and will continue to be done is we provide security, and then they take their time and do it at their pace. I say we force them to do it a lot faster for a lot of different reasons, and probably one of the more important reasons being that it'll save American lives and it'll save American financial resources. So we need to push them faster. They won't do a lot of the things that we want them to do until they feel like there's a gun to their head, so to speak. And for us to do that, we've got to pull back, let them get a lot bloodier than they are, and take more of the matters into their own hands more quickly. And it takes a lot of political will and courage for us to do that. It takes a certain amount of risk also, and this administration does not want to take that risk. I think that's wrong, and I think we need to do it faster, because I know the next administration is going to take that risk. And it's been over 5 years now. It's plenty of time. The military, we've seen some problems when they went down to Basra this past week, but they have the armament. They have the training. It's a matter of the right leadership and the right military and political. And, again, if they know that we're there to bail them out, they won't do the things that they need to be doing nearly as quickly. So we need to pull back a bit, yes, be there for the important things strategically to bail them out on, but let them do it, and it's their own way. You know, we always, as Americans, expect American standards, and that goes the same in the military, and that's a mistake, and we understand that, the essence of that, but I think sometimes forget that at times. Their planning is much different than ours. It's off the British model, et cetera. It's slower. You know, the people that they have in power, anybody that was taking initiative was killed by Saddam. But we've had 5 years, and it's time to push them more into the fight. I went from my bio into Iraq, but I thought it was kind of a natural progression. What else can I tell you?
Oh, yes, and certainly we'll get to domestic issues. But, yep. Doug, you sound like you have the experience and the knowledge on Iraq and Afghanistan as good as any congressional challenger that I know. Yeah. I think we've talked to on the Kudzu Vine. And probably, I mean, I just don't know how many folks running for Congress have served in both war zones. What do you think that, I mean, to me, I'm thinking it's the Democratic Party nationally, even though the 7th District's not the most swingable district. I'm thinking, wow, this guy's got such experience. We got to highlight this guy some way. What do you think the campaign can do to bring it to that point where people like know, oh, this is Doug Heckman. He's a Democratic guy that was one of the first 1,000 people in Afghanistan, served in both places.
Well, I mean, I hear what you're saying, and I thought about that, and I realized that I just started the campaign officially less than a week ago. But a couple things to answer your question, David. One, I've got a dynamite website that you all have seen, and David, I know you've seen it more than you probably want to see it. But you know, with technology, in many ways, more than we ever have been able to do in the past, I'm making that the centerpiece, with the pictures, the full sense of the man, so to speak, in this particular case. But so locally, I get as much coverage as I can get. But I think it's important from a national level to do more of that. So a couple things I'm going to do. One, there is one Iraqi veteran. No Afghan, but one Iraqi that's in Congress right now. He won in 2006 for the first time. His name is Patrick Murphy up in Pennsylvania. I'm going to be spending some time with him. Second, I'm going to spend some time with the DCCC up in Washington and highlight that fact so that they can use me as a resource where they need to. And, you know, everybody will understand that the welfare of the soldiers is foremost in my mind, and I'm not out to sharpshoot or Monday morning quarterback anything that's done in the past. But the way the forward in the future, based on my experience in those two regions over there, is salient to the discussion, and I will make sure that the DCCC understands that coming from me. So I guess the third prong is that there are a couple what I would call relatively conservative, others would call moderate, others would call populist, people in Congress, one of them being Jim Webb up in Virginia. Another guy, a West Point graduate, is Jack Reed out of Rhode Island, and I'm going to spend time with them and highlight my experience with them, and hopefully they will be advocates for me with the power structures up there in Washington.
Yes, well, I'll tell you what, I don't want to ask all the questions. I want to let Tim and Catherine ask you some questions. So, Catherine, go ahead and ask a question to Doug.
Well, first of all, Doug, thank you so much for your service, and thank you very much for stepping forward to run against Linder. We really appreciate it, and we always appreciate anyone who's willing to run for office as a Democrat. One of the things that's been on my mind this week is campaign finance. I don't know if our listeners understand that as of right about now, we have spent $426 million in the primary. That's just the top three candidates that are remaining. In the primary, we have raised, I should say, $426 million. And
wow.
I'm sure that you're facing these kind of questions now as you're running for Congress and against, I'm sure, a very well-funded
yes.
Republican.
Right.
And I'm just wondering if you – I didn't notice any discussion of it on your website, and I know it's a little bit of an esoteric conversation and topic, but I do
right.
think that that's a lot of money that could have been used for a lot of other things. And it's our money, you know, that's the lion's share of that is individuals making political contributions. And I think
right.
that's great. I mean, I'm not scorning anyone for making them, but I do think if we had different campaign finance regulations, we might not need to raise that kind of money. So I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on the whole campaign finance reform.
Well, I mean, that's a good question, Catherine, and I've kind of focused the genesis of my campaign on a number of different issues, which I highlight on my website. Campaign finance has not been one of them. You know, it's a two-edged sword in that, on the one hand, we should be free to raise as much as we want and from wherever we want, and that's kind of a basic freedom, I think, that our forefathers had in mind on some level. On the other hand, like so many things, maybe it's out of control from the standpoint of it's just too much money going into the system, and it becomes, you know, your job is in a two-year term as a congressman is to raise money to the detriment of doing your job. So certainly from a challenger standpoint, I wish I didn't have to worry about it. I guess it would be the first thing I'd say to you. Whether it's right or wrong, I don't know. A lot of smart people give positions on both sides, I guess. But, you know, the average congressional campaign for the House of Representatives is over $1 million now, and my opponent has $1 million essentially in the bank right now. And there are three sources of money I found, and maybe other people might be able to illuminate me more on it. But I've got a friend that's a congressman up there now. He happens to be a Republican, but we went to West Point together. But the three sources of income, one, individuals, which has a challenger, is the most important source. Two is from other political candidates that can help you out because they're running unopposed or they have a big war chest. I might be able to tap into that a little bit. And three is PACs. And PACs generally, if you're an incumbent, you got lots of PAC money flowing in no matter what. You can screw up and still get that money. But as a challenger, it's very, very difficult. And if you're not viewed as a close challenger, you've got none of that money. And that's the biggest source of money for most incumbents. So, you know, what the right answer for reform is, I don't know. You know, I mean, I saw what John McCain did, became Feingold, and it turned out to be the wrong way to handle a perceived problem, it sounds like. But I guess what I'm saying to you is I'm probably not knowledgeable enough to have a real great informed opinion, except that, you know, it's going to be a huge part of me being a viable candidate. I do know that. And if it was funded, you know, by the government, and it was a relatively level playing ground, certainly from a challenger standpoint, it would be the best place to be. And on some level, you know, it would be pretty democratic. And I mean it with the small d, to be on a relatively level playing field. And we all know that, you know, it's 90-whatever percent of incumbents are reelected every year, and it is such an uneven playing field. So I don't know what the answer is. I probably outlined both sides of it a bit.
I think it'll probably become more and more important to you.
Yeah, no, I hear you. I mean, my job is to raise as much money as I can, so I actually got a good start this week, so I'm hoping to capitalize on it try to. You know, in the Atlanta market, it's such a centralized market that I don't think TV is going to be as big as it is in many other markets for a lot of reasons. But I figure I need to raise at least a few hundred thousand, and I think I can do that. I think I can do that over the next few months. So.
Well, I think that there's a lot of interest in Democratic candidates this year. I was really pleased to see how much money Jim Martin was able to raise in just a, you know.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
So
yeah,
I think it's a good time to be running as a Democrat. And
no,
especially
absolutely.
With your record,
absolutely.
I think you have a really good shot at that seat, and we'll do everything we can to help you.
Thanks, Catherine. I appreciate it. You know, I mean, you know, I'm not, you know, I guess the other part of it is that if you're sitting in San Francisco, people are going to say, is this guy really a Democrat? And you know, I'm a fiscal, you know, fiscal conservative in many ways. And really all I mean by that is I think that we need to balance the budget, you know. I'm strong in national defense, so I hate to be trite about it, but I'm probably more of a Sam Nunn type of a Democrat, which in my district I think will be potentially electable versus other districts where I'm probably less electable.
Well, that brings me to my next question. I noticed that you were supported a national consumption tax on your
I do not support a national consumption tax.
Oh, you don't?
Oh,
okay.
You know what, Catherine? I mentioned it at the end there as kind of an alternative that in an attempt to simplify the tax system, a potential solution, in my opinion, would be to possibly cut some income taxes and institute somewhat of a consumption tax in opposition to my opponent, who is the fair tax guru, who says go to total consumption. And I am all against that.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. I'm glad to hear that's just a possibility that it's not.
Well, and the consumption tax, I mean, I kind of make a statement there, or one sentence, but the consumption tax would be on certain things also. So we're not talking about foodstuffs and everyday living type of thing.
Like a luxury tax.
It would be more of a luxury tax, yeah, but
okay.
Maybe somewhere in the middle there, you know, it wouldn't just be cars and boats. It might be a bit more than that,
mm-hmm.
But it wouldn't be going to the grocery store or buying gasoline kind of taxes.
Okay, that's good. Tim,
and,
I know you have a question.
And the intent there is to simplify the system. Take that thick book and chop it to, you know, one-tenth of its size, and that type of thing, a simplification overall.
Okay.
Mr. Heckman, before we have to let you go, we always like to ask our candidates, let's say there's someone in the 7th District who's listening tonight, they say, you know, I really like the sound of this guy, I'd like to do what I can to help him. How about giving us some of your contact information or letting our listeners know what they can do to help your campaign?
Well, I appreciate you asking me to do that. I guess the first thing I would say to you, and David mentioned at the beginning, my website, which has everything on it in case you don't write fast enough, is DougHeckman.com, and that's DougHeckman.com. I guess that's the first thing. It has all my positions on there, or at least the 5 most important to me, et cetera, as well as the bio information and ways you can contribute. Then I'd say to you that, you know, you can sign up for updates on there, for emails, if you so desire, and I would certainly appreciate you contribute, all those type of things. And again, on that website, it's my phone number, and it's got my P.O. box, and it's got my email address, which is simply DougHeckman2008@gmail.com. That's Google Mail, gmail.com. So that's all the contact information. And, you know, as everybody knows, the 7th District has been overwhelmingly Republican. I think that this election is going to be different than the last few. So the timing is right for a moderate to conservative Democrat to challenge John Linder, who has been there a long time and I don't think really wants to fight. He's got a primary fight on his hands to start out with, and then he's going to have a fight in November. So with either Obama or Hillary, I think that we're going to have a big turnout, and we're going to make this a dogfight. I really believe that, and it's my job to get people to believe that I'm the right man to represent us, and we really have a shot out there in this election cycle.
Okay, Mr. Heckman, we thank you for being with us, and we look forward to talking to you again before the election.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Thank you.
David? It was great to have Doug on. I mean, I'm just blown away at the experience he has on Afghanistan and Iraq. I think that's, he just has such a good picture of it to really talk from a knowledge base. And that takes us right to the end of the hour. I just want to real quickly preview next week's show. Cheryl Sable, who's running for Congress in Alabama's 2nd District, is going to join us. And Rashad Taylor, the Democratic Party of Georgia, is going to be on. And this is going to be the final kudzu vine before the delegate selection process for Georgia. And he's going to take anybody's questions that has questions about how to run. So that'll give them 6 days to put that information into action. We hope a lot of folks will use that opportunity to call into Rashad, and we'll have the details about how folks can do that. But I guess any closing thoughts, Catherine or Tim?
Well, I'm sorry I took so long. Thank
That's
you.
That's no problem. And I tell you what, Tim, go ahead. Your outrage of the week over to me. I'll get it to Catherine. If Catherine will post it on Blog for
Absolutely.
Democracy, everybody can read that and then also hear about Doug and Andy Brack's comments throughout the show.
Will do.
Thanks, guys. Good night.
Thank you.
See you next week.